Hey everybody, thanks for listening to the Fanzine podcast. Just before we get started with the show, this is your host Tony Fletcher. I want to invite you to sign up for the weekly newsletter over at tonyfletcher.substack.com. It'll give you updates on this podcast, my other podcasts, all forms of recommendations with a midweek update, a long form weekend read. Sign up is absolutely free. There are interview archives, additional podcast features, and you will be able to see more of the fanzines that we're talking about on this show. That's tonyfletcher.substack.com. Thanks again. Now on with the pod.
It's the Fanzine.
Fanzine podcast.
I mean, the thing about a fanzine was holding it in your hand, right? And looking at the way it'd been put together, and the punk way it'd been put together, quite frankly, and it had a staple in it, you know, and that is a fanzine, right?
Hey everybody, just before I jump into the wonderful conversation that forms this particular episode, I want to give regular listeners a little bit of a background, maybe perhaps especially for those in the USA rather than the UK. For over 40 years now, football fanzines have run parallel to music fanzines in the UK. Growing out of the same, what do we want to call it, alternative pop culture, as did the punk and new wave zines of the 1970s and early 80s. And as evidenced perhaps by the fact that the best known and longest running of what I will call the non-denominational zines, When Saturday Comes, took its name from a song by the new wave band from Northern Ireland, The Undertones. At the football fanzine culture's peak in probably what was the late 1980s, it's estimated there were at least 300 such football fanzines publishing regularly. Now, where the football fanzines differ from the music ones is that most of them are denominational, i.e. loyal to one particular club. So if When Saturday Comes, which is a national, even international zine, is like an alternative to the glossy football magazine, say the same way that a long-running music fanzine like The Big Takeover, whose Jack Rabbit was featured just a couple of episodes back, serves as like an authentically or more authentically independent voice than a Spin magazine or a Mojo magazine, the majority of the football zines serve more like alternatives to their stated club's official club programme. So in this context, the Arsenal fanzine, The Gooner, whose Kevin Witcher joins us on this episode, is maybe like a Taylor Swift fanzine. Economically removed from its subject it's writing about, but passionate about it all the same. Arsenal being one of the top six clubs in the UK and possibly on target, or very much on target, to win the English Premier League this year. On the other hand, Bradford City's City Gem, whose editor Mike Harrison is also featured on this episode, would be perhaps more comparable to a zine dedicated to like a cult band that refuses to go away. I don't know, Guided by Voices or Teenage Fan Club, something like that. And even as football fan culture moves largely online to YouTube channels and podcasts, there's always going to remain a dedicated, if discerning, audience that is willing to read articles and opinion pieces that bring the banter of what we once knew as the football terraces to print. Kevin and Mike are joined here by When Saturday Comes, his co-founder and ongoing editor over four decades now almost, Andy Lyons, for a conversation that discusses the various three zines' origins, their rise to influence and prominence, their engagement and effect on the game they support, and how they keep going after that four decades and several hundred issues apiece in the face of the younger fans' migration online. The episode also discusses the tragic fire that took place at Bradford City's ground in May 1985, at which City Gent editor Mike Harrison was in attendance. While we don't get into any gory detail, I do want to let listeners be prepared. For the record, the football film entitled When Saturday Comes had nothing to do with the football fanzine, though the fact that it chose that title perhaps speaks to the effect that WSC, as it's often known, had on the culture in the 1980s and 90s especially. The episode was recorded while I was in the UK, me sat at my mother's dining table without my usual high-tech gear, and you'll hear a little echo on my voice as a result, or a little reverb, I should say, what we call room reverb, large room reverb. It's been edited a little for time, and I offer one voiceover to cut down on what our American listeners might understand to be inside baseball waffling. If you are here for the music, please do stick around because fanzines take many, many forms, and I can only think of the sci-fi zine scene that has outlasted the soccer. I call it, yes, soccer, zine, scene, other than the music ones, of course, for longevity and consistency. And with that, over to the podcast. Go! Welcome, everybody, to episode 25 of the Fanzine podcast. And this is an episode I've been wanting to do all the way down the line. And I hope the American listeners, of which there are many to this show, I really hope you're going to enjoy this because it's a massive part of the fanzine culture. And there will be equivalents for sure in the States. And similarly, if you're listening in any other country, I happen to be in the UK at the moment. I wanted to do this episode while in the UK, even though we're doing it on Zoom. And this episode is all about football fanzines, which has been a vibrant part of the fanzine culture for decades now. And just to give an example, the people I'm talking to here all have fanzines that are now in the several hundredth issue. Several hundredth, I'm up to episode 25 of a podcast. We're in the several hundreds, and there's going to be a long and illustrious history here. I'm taking the risk of having three guests because they're all notable, they're all different, and they should give us a fantastic balance to talk about this this really, really great aspect of fanzine culture. All four of us are male with either shaven or follically challenged heads, which I think speaks to the football culture a lot. It's quite amusing, I must say. We're all of a type, and that's fair enough. I have Andy Lyons from When Saturday Comes. How are you today, Andy?
I'm good, Tony. Nice to be here.
It is lovely, lovely to have you on board. We have Mike Harrison from City Gent, which is a Bradford City fanzine. How are you, Mike?
Yeah, I'm good, thank you.
Great. Are you in
Thanks
Bradford?
For inviting me to this.
Oh, absolutely. I'm so happy to have you. Are you in Bradford, by the way? Is that where you live?
I live in Shipley, but I live about 3 miles away from Valley Parade, so I'm within spitting distance.
There we go. And we have Kevin Witcher from The Gooner, which is an Arsenal fanzine. I believe that you edited it for a long, long time, so you may have passed on that baton, but you were editor of The Gooner, an Arsenal fanzine for a long, long time. Kevin, how are you today?
I'm very well, thank you, Johnny.
Great. I want to start off by saying that I'm really happy to have the three of you because of the balance. When Saturday Comes is a national fanzine / magazine. It calls itself the Half Decent Football Magazine and has been on, Americans would call newsstands, but it's certainly on what's left of newsagent shelves in the UK. And I wanted to get a balance of a big club, a top six club, which Arsenal certainly is. And we've got that with Kevin, and then get the balance of with absolutely all respect, you know, a smaller club in terms of current status, and that is Bradford City. But Bradford City has an equally, you know, long and in its own way an illustrious history. And inadvertently, because I was actually looking at maybe getting a Liverpool or Man United fanzine on board, inadvertently, I'm actually also glad I've got a club based in the north and a club based in the south, because that's also of interest to me in some ways. Let's jump right in. All of these zines, like I say, are several decades old, but I have a feeling, and I may need to stand corrected, but I have a feeling When Saturday Comes would have come first. Andy, were you there at the beginning of When Saturday Comes?
Yes. The idea developed, a friend of mine, Mike Tisher, we were working together in the record shop. It's R Price Records in Kensington High Street, which for American listeners won't know, but it's a kind of a posh area of London. It's near recording studios. We used to get a lot of musicians coming. Morrissey actually came in once, Tony, and bought a couple of Billy Fury LPs.
There you go. Perfect, right? Not absolutely to type.
And he didn't make any eye contact. It was one of those things where he's like, I know that you know who I am, so I won't look at you when I hand over my money, which used to happen quite a bit. So Mike had experience of doing a music zine called Snipe, which ran for a few issues, about three or four issues. And we used to talk about football a lot in breaks while we were working at the shop, various things to do with, we'd ask each other questions about football and so forth. And the image of football fans at the time, of course, in the mid-80s was terrible. I mean, Anyone who didn't follow football there might think that football fans were hooligans. You know, that was the broader perception. And we just had this idea, maybe we could do, as a spin-off from the music scene, a small football zine, soccer zine. And the first one was owned in March 86. So it gestated for quite a long time. Mike sent a copy of that first issue, his 15p cover price, to The Guardian, and they had a news column on a Saturday, and they gave it a mention. We had we were living in the same house at the time. We had 100 letters the following Monday or Tuesday from people. We had to do the first issue is 15p. We had to do a reprint, made it 20p. So capitalism already. We increased the price by 5p to get the second letter. So we were completely astonished by the response it got. And essentially what we discovered was that there were already one or two zines around. In fact, I think that City Gent, which we didn't know about at the time, is actually older than WSC. I think City Gent started in 85, I think.
It definitely
and we started in 86.
If you want to me nip in here, the first issue of the City Gent came out in the very beginning of November 1984.
Mm. Oh, right, yeah, yeah.
So it would have been in production in October of 84.
Yeah. So we discovered fairly quickly that there were already some zines around. There weren't many at that point, but over the next kind of couple of years, the underground zine thing, there'd obviously be music zines already. Football zines thing really mushroomed. So by the end of the 80s, or certainly by the start of the 90s, there were hundreds. We used to have a listing. We'd try and update a telephone directory kind of listing of addresses. And at one point, I think there were probably about 300 covering vast majority of clubs in the league. So we discovered, obviously, there was already a kind of a subculture in the making. And it was a way for us to contact like-minded people around the country, all of whom felt as we did, you know, the image of football fans, broadly speaking, was wrong or was misplaced, and that we weren't all hooligans, and we wanted to show that, you know, to discuss a whole range of things that football fans would talk about, to do with kind of things you talk about on your way to a game, or serious and funny stuff, a combination really.
Yeah, so thank you for that, Andy. So it actually does confirm that the sort of notion of a club zine, which might be a comparison to somebody starting a fanzine about a band, a specific band, that actually came first, and the idea of more of a national zine, one that could encapsulate the whole culture, maybe followed on. And of course, as anybody who has been listening to this show knows, although fanzines have been around in one shape or form forever, but certainly called as much since the 40s, the scene was especially vibrant in the UK in the 80s. It was, for various reasons that we discussed on previous episodes, there were hundreds and then thousands of fanzines around the country in the mid-80s, and it made sense for it to sort of spread sideways, if you like, sort of laterally over to over the football, which is as big a part of British pop culture, social culture, as music is. So Mike, just briefly there, you started in 1984, ahead of the idea of a national zine. Were you aware of other zines? What was the inspiration for getting a zine going about Bradford City that year?
So I wasn't involved in 84. The idea of the fanzine was started by one of our previous editors, John Watmuth, who still helps me, still writes for the magazine. He'd seen a fanzine at York City called Terrace Talk, and also there was quite a vibrant, because the way the football club was, you know, pretty much in the doldrums in the 83-84, to give a bit of context, the club went into administration in 83, almost went bust, kept going, so there was a lot of fan involvement, even insofar as the coach travel was run by the what was called the City Travel Club 73, which is, you know, set up in 1973. So the City Gent came out really as a fanzine for, taking inspiration from Terrace Talk from York City, but also then just about the travelling on the coaches using the independent coach, you know, CTC 73. So it was very much that sort of a production, really. And it was one of those remarkable things. I mean, 84-85 was a remarkable season for Bradford City, as it was, because we not only won the third division championship, but of course it's more now remembered for the fire that happened on May 11th, on the last game of the season.
Which but I'm going the, to, which I am going to come to.
And I think that the people behind the fanzine to start with were in many ways, like Andy was saying, rather surprised just how much of an interest there was going to be in this little 20p magazine that was coming out. I mean, they produced six magazines in the first season. Each of them progressively sold more than the previous one. And I think probably by the time of the end of the first season, maybe the price went up to 30p. I'll just check. But yes, it did. Oh, well, into the second season, we're into 30p. So, and I think because what football fans were finding, especially at our level, was that other than you buy the local paper and there might be something on the back page about the football club, and yeah, you could buy the club program, which was very limited, maybe 16, 20 pages. Not a lot of information was coming out of the football club about your team, as it were. And very much, you know, as Andy was saying, I think it's just like fans wanted to talk to fans in the same way that, you know, you'd go to the pub after the game and talk about the game. People have this now, they have this fanzine where basically you could actually write articles in very much the same talk about, well, you know, let's talk about the games, talk about how we all the misadventures we had going on the coach to Barnsley or whatever. And it grew from there. And I think, you're right, obviously, pointing out that, you know, fanzines existed before. And I think you look at all the sort of the punk fanzines that came through the end of the 70s, and they're very much like punk music was, well, like, so it's just DIY. Why can't we do it on our own? We don't need to sign up for it. So, and I think the technology in, let's say, obviously, City Gent for 1984 was all very sort of nascent and just coming out. So it just meant that people could actually produce their own things. They didn't have to sort of, you know, get other people to do it. It was all very much DIY. It was all cut and paste, letter set, that sort of thing.
Exactly. I think really that was part of the culture. And it was probably also, I'm aware, I think that there was an increased reaction to sort of Thatcherism as well. There was an alternative culture going on. That there was more of a sort of, you know, as the country sort of leaned rightwards and more capitalist, there was a, you know, pushback from a lot of people who wanted to have a more community oriented involvement in their society. Kevin, obviously your turn. I'm not sure if you were there at the start of the Gooner, but take us through the start of the Gooner. And I'm really interested whether the reasons that City Gent started up also apply to a much bigger club like Arsenal.
To an extent, yes, because what happened was the original founder of the Gooner, a guy called Michael Francis, was working in an office with a Chelsea fan. And he was being ribbed because Chelsea had a fanzine and Arsenal didn't. So Mike thought, okay, I'll produce one then. So he ran it off. He produced it on the Works photocopier. And funnily enough, the first issue wasn't even sold at matches. He just took it to sports pages, which I'm sure we may mention at some point. And issue two onwards, he started just actually standing outside Highbury selling copies, gradually got other people who joined in. And it just grew. I got involved in late 1989. And for the first sort of 10 years of my involvement with the fanzine, I was quite heavily involved in the distribution and sales side, as well as contributing articles. And I became an editor in 2000 when Mike just got too busy to continue doing it himself. But what was interesting was to witness the growth of the fanzine, because much as the matchday program is always going to outsell it, there was a hell of a lot of interest in the Gooner, and people, when we were successful in certain seasons, we used to sell out quite regularly, which was hugely encouraging and kept me very busy because I was involved on the sales side and organising the sellers and all that kind of thing. But ultimately, the Gooner started simply because of a jibe in an office at work, and Mike responded. As for myself, I also did actually start a couple of other fanzines just on the smaller scale, but didn't last so long.
Were they football, music, or something else?
They were a mix, actually, because I did one for the English national team, which didn't last long. It started off being called the Italian Job as we moved towards Italia 90, and then we had to change the name, which became the Hand of God. But we were always compromised on that because it's so hard to sell anything outside Wembley Stadium because of Brent local, Brent Council, and their officious nature. I also did a very briefly an American football fanzine called Hail Mary, which was sold, kind of anything that was relevant in London at the time.
So, you know, I wouldn't have known there was an American football fanzine in the 80s. There you go, you see.
Small scale, ran for about 6 or 7 issues. I also started another Arsenal fanzine, just to use some of the material that the Gooner wasn't. It was called Up the Arse, and it was just purely irreverent. I mean, there's no, serious side to that whatsoever. It was just purely pee-taking, as it were. So,
it's good. Very fine. What year did you stop editing? I know you wrote to me and said you were editing for about 20 years.
Yeah, so I handed over the reins in 2020, which was actually very good timing. It was actually arranged before COVID happened, but in terms of the future of the fanzine, fair play to the guy who took it over, Laith Youssef, because frankly, it's an uphill battle these days, as other guys will testify.
Yeah, we'll get to talking about that with the internet and whether where the fanzine culture lies, print in general. Did you tell me there at the beginning of that what year that the Gooner started?
It was October 1987, so a bit later to the party than the other guys. But
But you certainly caught up in number of issues. And this is something I really could and should have looked up beforehand, but I was so busy reading all your publications, to be honest. Is there another Arsenal fanzine of the same, of any comparable size?
The only one that's still going is the Supporters Club magazine, which actually started, in a way, it was the original fanzine because it started just after World War II. And yet it's not in the spirit of the fanzines for a long time because it was never critical and it was not that much humour. It was quite straightforward. Right. In the last 10, 15 years, they've got more into the groove of sometimes having to go at the club and putting more gags in.
But basically, the Gooner is the Arsenal fanzine. If you want an Arsenal fanzine, it's the Gooner.
Now, there were some others in the 90s. There were about 4 or 5 going at the same time in the 90s. But now it's...
So you've lasted the course. Okay, yeah. Great. I appreciate all those excellent introductions about how, when and why. And I think, the 80s is a constant there. And feel free here, from here on in many ways to just sort of go back and forth and join in on each other's comments and as they bounce off, and I can keep us on track. But I'm always interested when I talk to anybody, and we've had a really big variety of guests on this show already, sort of about how we define a fanzine. What's interesting to me when Saturday Comes has been on the shelves for feels to me like for decades. I mean, I always buy it when I come over. I don't know why I don't subscribe, but I also don't listen to Six Music in the States. There's certain things I just do when I'm back in Britain, and one of them is pick up When Saturday Comes. And yet it still feels like a fanzine. It's printed on sort of that old newspaper kind of stock. It's similar, if anybody knows Private Eye, it's got this sort of similar thing to it. So it hasn't gone glossy. But it's in colour. It's obviously got distribution. I wanted to ask Andy at some point if it's his full-time job. The Gooner, by comparison, is so colourful and professional, it could almost pass as an official programme. And City Gent sort of falls somewhere in between. It's got these incredible cartoons on the cover. I think almost every cover has had one. And other than that, though, could almost pass as a club program, but there's a lot in between the covers that distinguishes that you immediately, if you picked it up, you would know, okay, this can't be an official club program or When Saturday Comes has some other agenda. It's not merely a big publisher trying to capitalize on a whatever niche audience there is. So for each of you, and how do you define the nature of your being a fanzine as opposed to being some kind of just magazine? What, how do we define a football fanzine?
Well, WC eventually it became a full-time job in kind of summer of 88. So I suppose in a way you could say maybe it changes from a zine to a magazine once it starts to employ people full-time, and it's been my full-time job since then, so it's kind of 36 years. The reason it says Half Decent Football Magazine on the cover is when we finally got it into WH Smith's, which is the big retail magazine kind of selling place in the UK. We were told we should have the word football on the cover, because we often in those days used to have pictures on the cover that weren't very football. We'd have a picture of, say, the sports minister or somebody wearing a suit. It wouldn't immediately say sports, and they wanted to be able to put it in the sports section in their shops. So we came up with this phrase to do with football magazines. So I suppose from that point, as soon as it got into it became a regular monthly magazine and it was distributed and stuff. And I suppose it was kind of interchangeable, a zine or a magazine. I mean, we in the mid-90s, I'm kind of leaping forward slightly, but you can go back again. There was a sudden spate of glossy magazines appeared after we'd been going for about 8 years. There's only one of which is still going, called 442, and there were another three that launched fairly quickly. And one of them was published by IPC, which is a big publisher in the UK. It used to publish weekly music press papers, the NME and Melody Maker. And they also did a soccer magazine, which I think is still going, for mainly for kids, called Shoot. And they came to see us and asked us, they were basically had been told by their bosses they needed to produce a glossy football magazine to kind of rival 442, which is done by another publisher called Haymarket. And they asked us if we would be interested in moving once that comes over to IPC. So it would kind of upgrade and become like, I don't know, 140-page magazine. And we said no, because partly we wouldn't be the right people to do that. We wouldn't be suited to writing that kind of stuff. But also we felt there'd be no point in using that name, because we would lose the people who were already identified with When Saturday Comes wouldn't be interested in the glossy magazines. There's no point in calling it When Saturday Comes. You might as well start a new magazine, which is in fact is what they did. They launched a magazine. It was actually, they revived an old title that they'd owned in the 60s called Goal. But of these four magazines, only 442 survived more than a couple of years, because they're all very similar, and realistically nobody was going to buy more than one glossy magazine that was very similar. Whereas we had a kind of a niche, I suppose, at one end of the market. It kind of helped us in a way to define what we are, that we weren't a very kind of corporate looking magazine. The way I used to say it at the time was like, the big magazines were like these kind of big dinosaurs that were fighting each other, and we were this smaller, more evolved creature that they couldn't see, and we were kind of running around their feet. So we escaped their attention.
You were the mammal. You were the mammal that
survived, yes,
the extinction of the dinosaurs.
Or some kind of small, like a small feathered bird or something that was just learning to fly. Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, that's a good story. And certainly for me, Between the Covers, When Saturday Comes, still feels very much like a fan-oriented zine, regardless of I mean, and people know my background with jamming. I mean, we also kind of went and employed people, and you could argue it stopped being a fanzine and became a magazine, but you only had to pick up the copy to see all the mistakes pretty much on page two and know that it wasn't being run by IPC. So I understand where you're coming from on that, Andy. The differences, you managed to make this last as your full-time job and I didn't, but yeah. But there you go. Mike and Kevin, you know, how do you keep yourselves alternative and define a football fanzine, really?
I mean, for me, I think it's a lot to do with the people that write for it and for the club fanzines. I mean, I don't think anybody ever gets paid for writing for a fanzine. So it's people who are writing from the heart because they want to invest their time to express their opinion and get it seen. And in this day and age, in a long form way that you don't always get online. So for me, it's also the fact that it doesn't toe the club line. You know, editorially, it's going to be different from something which, for example, might rely partly on patronage from the club or particular advertisers. So it has to play safe. But fanzines don't have to do that. They play by their own rules and they're just coming from a different place. So for me, that's what distinguishes it.
Yeah, Mike?
I mean, yeah, I think the fact with the City Gent is that, yeah, none of us get paid for doing this. It's all volunteers. I think we were really lucky that the people set it up had a really good, I say, a good background. You know, they were all, I'm not say they're budding journalists, but there were certainly, you know, of a type that were slightly more intelligent than the average fans, and therefore to actually have the wherewithal to put this together. Yeah, not everybody stayed the course, but you know, I mentioned John Watmuth earlier on, who you know, talks about the fact that he spotted terrorist talk, and he suggested this, and then you know, Brian Fox and John Dewis got it together. Brian Fox is still around. John Dewis is still around. Mick Dickinson, the second editor, he's still around, albeit he's in Japan. But he wrote an article for me in this latest issue. There's a lot of us that have stayed the course over the last 40 years, and yeah, and the fact we pick up new people, be it you know, it always pleases me to pick up a few youngsters that want to, you know, they are budding journalists, so they want to get something on their CV to say, "Wow, I've had something printed in a fanzine. Look at me." And yeah, it's funny. I mean, each issue I start off with 56 or 64 blank pages. I'm thinking, am I going to fill this again? And somehow we do. I don't know how it happens, but we do. Kevin mentioned about being independent from the club. Yeah, we're very much an independent fanzine. We've now outlived the club program. Club program, the last one was produced the end of two seasons ago. So we've had two seasons now with no club programs. And of course, whereas we used to always get said, "Is that the club program?" No, it's not. It's a fanzine. Now, of course, people say, "Is that the club program?" No, the club program doesn't even exist anymore. So if you'd have told us 40 years ago that we would have outlived the club program, we wouldn't have believed that at all.
Well, yeah, none of us can predict the future. There's something that was in, you sent me, Mike and Kevin, you both sent me some copies of the issues that you put out. And Mike, you very consciously sent me issue 200, which is one from May 2015, which is one of the only ones that doesn't have a cartoon on the cover. There's a good reason for that. And inside, you mentioned Brian there as one of the founders. Brian Fox, and he has written in the middle of a piece that this is going to provide a good segue, actually. He's actually said that fanzines need to maintain a healthy distance between themselves and their respective clubs, or they will inevitably drift away from their supporters. Just as the fanzine isn't the appropriate medium to promote the club line, it's equally ill-equipped for serious investigative journalism. Its tone is more akin to the, "So what if I'm talking crap, it's Saturday afternoon," banter of the terraces. And I actually was reading that earlier and thought that is a great definition of a football fanzine. This notion that in a way it's for people on, you know, what used to be the terraces, but it's for the everyday person, man, woman, child, and then, you know, anybody who identifies otherwise to go to, you know, who goes to the ground and has some banter and enjoys, you know, meeting with friends before and afterwards, to be able to get those opinions down on paper and not just in a conversation, as I think one of you said earlier. The reason that paragraph was in there is that issue 200 was a 30th commemorative issue of the Bradford Fire, which you mentioned earlier. The quality of the writing in this commemorative issue is stunning. It's really stunning. I couldn't read it all. I was way too emotional. And I don't know if you were there, and I don't want to trigger anything if you were there. But I do think it's important for listeners to just, you know, especially younger listeners, to just have a sense of why Bradford has a special place. It's not why I chose City Gent. It was recommended to me by our good friend Richard Edwards. And I thought, great, cartoons on the cover, been going 30 years, let's have you. Only after I contacted you did I realise there was another aspect. So are you able to just reference and tell us a little bit what happened, and if it's not too emotional?
No, I'm fine. And of course, being editor of the City Gent, and just to add in for the listeners, and that I started selling, very much like Kevin, really, I ended up starting selling City Gent in February of 1987. And for a good 17 seasons, I was just selling the magazine and writing articles as well. It then became my turn almost to be the editor in the summer of 2004. when the previous editor wanted to stand down. And since then, I've not been able to pass it on to anybody else. So I've just now done 20 years editing the City Gent. So basically half the lifespan of the City Gent. And yeah, we like to claim that we're the longest running printed fanzine going, because all the ones that started previous to us no longer exist, as it were. Albeit I do take Kevin's point about the Arsenal fan thing that has been going since just after the war. So whether or not they might want to claim it, that's another matter. Yeah, I mean, being the editor of the City Gent, I tend to be the first person or first point of call when the media want to talk about the anniversary. Next month we're on to 39 years. I'm not expecting much interest. I'm expecting it when we get to 40 years next year, as we had at 35, at 30, etc. So the 30th one.
Just tell us briefly what actually happened on May 11th. Can you please.
So Bradford City, we had an illustrious start to our career as a football team, because we got elected into the Football League without even playing a game. We won the FA Cup in 1911. We were very much like an Edwardian type team that did very, very well up until the First World War. After the First World War, we fell out of the First Division and then down the leagues. In 1984-85, and this is just 2 years out of surviving administration, we had this fantastic season. We won the Third Division Championship. Now, this is massive for Bradford City, because our only other titles were Second Division in 1908, the FA Cup, and the Third Division North in something like 1929. So the fourth trophy in our 80-year history. It was just a massive season. And then, of course, Valley Parade, like a lot of football grounds at the time, were, no investment made in, just run on a shoestring, keep it going. And I think you've got to put into context, having just survived administration in 1983, you can imagine that there wasn't a lot of money spent on the ground just to keep it going. Now, obviously, we were going to go into the Second Division. There were plans to re-roof the ground, re-roof the main stand, because they knew it wasn't suitable. We managed to win the championship, the title on May Day, Bank Holiday Monday, away at Bolton. So, of course, come Saturday, May the 11th, home game against Lincoln City, last game of the season, nothing riding on it. It's just a pure day of celebration. So it was a really much a party mood. There was 11,000 people there, which was higher than usual. Because everybody wasn't there for the football, just to see Bradford City win a trophy, the only the fourth time in the history. I was in the stand opposite. Having said that, on May the 4th, I was sat in the main stand when we had a home game against Reading. The fire could have happened that day. The fire could have happened any day. But for some reason, it just happened to happen 3 minutes before halftime. I could see from my vantage point, diagonally opposite, because I was stood towards Bradford end, that there seemed to be something going on. I even went into the corner, because in those days we had like police used to stand by the corner flag. And I said to the guy, "Is everything all right over there?" He said, "Oh, no, everything's under control, no worries." And obviously, if you look at the footage, there is a few policemen just stood there. And people are just looking at the fire. They weren't even thinking it was going to be that, that serious. And all of a sudden, then it did really become very serious. It was just a nightmare scenario. And,
it engulfed the stand, didn't it, in a matter of moments? It did engulf
within 4 minutes, it had gone from this fairly innocuous little fire that had got underneath. And, obviously afterwards they said it started with the debris that was underneath the stand, because obviously they didn't really clear out all the bits of newspapers and things that used to fall through the gaps in the wooden floorboards. It was just a combination of the wind being in the wrong direction, the type of bitumen that was on the roof, everything just worked. It was one of those freak things, because Yeah, perfect storm. I mean, it was an Archibald Leitch stand that had been built in something like 1908 or something. It had been going week in, week out for 70-odd years. And typically, you know, it only had to last another hour because it was going to be re-roofed after that.
I know. There's so many elements to this, isn't there? The size of the crowd, the fact that it was meant to be a celebration. And 56 people lost their lives, correct?
Yeah. Yeah, that's right. So we never forget there was always two fans from Lincoln that lost their lives, as well as 54 from Bradford. 250-odd people were injured that day. And when you look at it, you think, actually, it was remarkable that more people didn't get injured, more people didn't die in that. And there's lots of heroic tales of people helping people out of the stand. Sadly, Paul Firth, who died a few years ago, wrote an excellent book, which I can always recommend to people if you want to find it. It's called 4 Minutes to Hell. It's by Paul Firth. You read the book and then all of a sudden you get to the end of the book and you think, when he talks about his own escape and how he escaped from that stand, it's a miracle, absolute miracle. And he became a great advocate for putting the record straight about the fire. Because, I don't know, it's one of those things where some people say, oh, it's like the forgotten disaster. Because, of course, 2.5 weeks later, me, you, Andy, Kevin, we're all sat at home probably watching the European Cup final from Brussels. And all of a sudden, there's another disaster happening on the BBC in front of your eyes. I don't know if it tended to, but it did, and I'm sure Andy will come in on this because of obviously covering all clubs, but the aftermath, you know, that fire changed football, and thankfully, touch wood, we've not had such a fire at a football ground since, because all those old wooden stands got condemned. And, you know, we'd get messages from other clubs saying, you know, there, but for the grace of God, because that could have happened at our football club. Because we had the same situation. It just happened to happen at Bradford City. And it was just a really freak. We always maintain it's a freak accident. Regarding issue 200, the 30th anniversary, a lot of people wrote first-time articles for the first time in 30 years because they just couldn't bear to do it up until that point. On the back of that, I think, you know, obviously we won the fanzine of the year for 2015, which was really pleasing. But it was an attempt just to put a different fan's perspective on the day. And we sort of felt, I sort of felt forced into it. It's not something that we readily do. I mean, you look at issue 7 for the following season and Brian makes virtually no reference to the fire at all.
Yeah, that's interesting. It's really interesting. I think there often has to be a passing of time before you can go back and look at something. The quality of the writing, like I say, in that commemorative issue is really important. And I also, sympathies, commiserations, and you know the fact that you were there. And I appreciate you recounting it for listeners who may not know about it. But it also, I mean, it's sort of fascinating. You'd only just started the zine, but it football changed a lot as a result of Hillsborough, which followed, but as a result of the fire, Hazel, Hillsborough. And I'm interested whether we all think it's changed for the better because we all now have all seated stadiums. As you say, fire traps like this aren't meant to be allowed anymore. You know, clubs have gotten massive. You know, Arsenal are sponsored by, you've got the Emirates Stadium, you've got the naming rights. Let's bring ourselves right up to speed. I mean, I've got more to ask about, but you know, the game now, and I want to observe, like actually about two-thirds of the listeners to this show are in the UK, but because I live in the States, there's a lot in the States. Football, British football, the Premier League is massive in America. People keep asking me about this, and I'm like, it's enormous. The sport as a whole is enormous. Teams in the Northwest Pacific Northwest gets 60,000 a game. It hasn't seeped into the popular culture the way it's part of European and South American culture, but it's enormous. The Premier League, which to some degree you're representing here, Kevin, and I guess to some degree I am, is the biggest sporting franchise in the world. So where do football fanzines fit into like one of the biggest money businesses in the entire world? And I'm sort of interested, have we changed for the better, and where we're at now, kind of free for all, really. And Kevin, I mean, we should definitely get you back in on this, Kevin, because we haven't heard from you for a little bit. So please, yeah, if you want to go first, maybe.
Yeah. Well, first, just to reflect on something Mike said, I think what is really key there is that his fanzine gave a voice to people who probably would not have had any other way to express what they put in that issue. So I think you cannot underplay the significance of that. In terms of where fanzines stand in the modern age, I'll be honest with you, they're a relic. And I think if certainly anyone who sells fanzines outside a football stadium was asked, they would tell you that anybody under the age of pretty much 40 was not going to buy there, because people under 40 just don't buy printed matter. And the sort of argument I always make to anybody is, when was the last time you saw anybody under the age of 40 carrying a newspaper they paid for? So what fanzines are in that respect are, nowadays, I hate to say it, but we are pretty marginalised. Certainly when Saturday comes, it's still on the newsstands, which is wonderful that it continues to just survive, to be honest with you, as much as anything. And that almost goes for any printed magazine. But the people that keep fanzines going are doing so for the loyal audience that still want them. And it is a demographic, it is a certain age group, but the reality is that fan opinion has moved online in terms of genuine impact to numbers. Okay, so at Arsenal, for example, you have a YouTube channel which is quite at times sensational or sensationalist, called Arsenal Fan Television, which in fact Arsenal made them change the name to AFTV because of copyright. Yeah. Stuff, but anyway, the principle being they get millions of views. Fanzines at the best are selling, some of them sell more than 1,000. The Gooner manages to do that, but compared to what it used to sell, it's marginal. So I honestly hate to say it, but much as fanzines are a wonderful thing, they are becoming more and more niche. And although they do provide a voice to supporters who wish to write their thoughts and feelings and see them in published format, they are now marginalized in terms of influence, unlike 25 years ago, 20 years ago, when you could campaign about stuff. So, for example, at Arsenal, when Taylor Report meant it went all seating, we did a big campaign against the fact that the old North Bank stand was being converted into an all-seater, because we just didn't want it to happen, especially given the way the club were doing it, which involved you having to pay up £1,500 to buy some bond, which gave you the right to buy a season ticket in that stand. So it was just all wrong. It all felt wrong. And we were able to campaign against it, granted unsuccessfully, but at least we had a go. And there are other issues which over the years, such as racism, that kind of thing, which we've been able to, cover and give an opinion on. So I think fanzines were a thing of their time. They had much greater influence earlier on. But nowadays, they are a niche thing which doesn't have the influence, sadly, that it used to, because the world has changed. And the expansion of the Premier League is a reflection of how things have changed, because in the old days, in all fairness, football could be a dangerous sport to attend, not only because of the ramshackle nature of old stadiums, but because of the behaviour of supporters. And, you didn't see so many females at games. You did see kids, but they tended to quite often be in particular areas where, they could all watch the game together and it was a bit safer. But if you put them in the middle of the, you know, the Anfield cop, you know, they would have had to be on somebody's shoulders to even see anything. So on one level, the game has changed for the better. But obviously people of our sort of age have nostalgia for what we used to experience. And we always say the atmosphere was better. And I think to a large extent, that's true. But at the same time, the world has changed. Safety of people attending any event is now a priority. Yeah. And what went on 40, 50 years ago would not be allowed now.
No, in a lot of areas. And I've noticed that in general on this is my most extended trip back to the UK in almost 20 years for me, 2020. Actually, no, sorry, almost 30 years for me. So I'm noticing a lot of that. Andy, you have that kind of ability to have a long-range view here in that you cover all football. Would you agree with Kevin's assessment there?
Yeah, I think WSC itself has changed less than the football industry has over the time. As the guys have already mentioned, obviously, football, when we began, football was a relatively small business in the UK. No satellite TV, no clubs being owned by large corporations. Now it's become part of the global corporate world, and clubs are owned by Middle Eastern oil dynasties and American hedge funds, just as a large part of London is owned by the same people. So, I mean, WSC obviously is run as a business, but it's on a very small scale, really. We earn enough to pay staff wages and hopefully pay our tax bills. We've never made much of a profit beyond that. You know, I think it's still the case that our readers, in contrast to a lot of football fans in general, are people who follow football as a whole. So even if they support a team at the top level in the Premier League, they have an awareness of what's going on in the rest of football. And crucially, they're also people who go to games regularly rather than just watching it on TV. And I think being present at matches gives you a greater sense of being a participant in football, I think, rather than just someone who, you know, is just a spectator. I think at first we were probably a bit defensive about football in the way, because obviously football had been part of an important part of popular culture in the UK for like 100 years, and we felt that it wasn't perhaps getting enough credit in that way, and it almost like it needed to be protected a bit. Whereas now we've kind of gone the other way a bit, certainly in terms of top level football, in terms of we're sometimes skeptical of how it's being hyped up, you know. I mean, at WSC as a business, it's still a case we'll only ever appeal to a certain proportion of people who follow football, and most are happy to just receive their information and commentary from more mainstream sources, which is fine. So we've managed to retain an audience for this period, and it's close to 40 years because we have a certain amount of loyalty amongst our readers, I suppose, and our subscribers, rather than our sales and shops, are key to that. So, but our audience, our readership has got older as we have. So when we started, it'd be people in their 20s, kind of post-college age, people who read the weekly music press. Now the people in their kind of 50s and 60s, you know, and that's just how it is. We get a few younger people in, but not too many. And somebody said to me a little while ago, and they were tending to be complimentary, someone who's worked in the advertising industry, he said, yeah, I see WSC as a sort of heritage brand, he said. And I thought it made it sound like marmalade or, you know, a silver tea service. But I sort of understood what he meant. But that's just where we are. We're kind of, I think we're a name that people know. We turn up, we've been a question occasion on TV quiz shows. A couple of people occasionally tell us when we're going to be on over the years. So we're kind of around, kind of in the culture. A lot of people know who we are. But we're only ever going to have an appeal to a minority, a specialist audience, a right, discerning audience, as they say in Spinal Tap. You know, our audience has got more discerning over the years, and that's how it is.
Can I ask you, Andy, what the are you willing to? You probably have to anyway if you still do those ABC figures. What your circulation is these days?
Well, it's around yearly is probably about 14,000, something like that, which is roughly what we were selling in the late 80s. But we have about 9,000 subscribers.
Yeah,
so the subscribers are really crucial.
Yeah, I would have thought that would be the case. And for those who don't know it, I do want to, you know, I think When Saturday Comes is great. I've got the April issue here in front of me, and the variety, it's got the usual kind of Private Eye star. I mean, that is, you know, I think you originally may have got it from, you can disagree, but, you know, a picture on the cover with, you know, bubbles, speech bubbles on it. But you've got pieces, fan pieces, About I think there's one about when St Johnstone went to Monaco, somebody about supporting Bolton. These are not teams that come straight to people's minds when they're thinking of British football. You've got something about dementia in a fan story. That's important to me. My mother has very advanced dementia. She was a massive Crystal Palace fan. Victory for German protesters about, you know, changes going on in the leagues there. So there's a lot of emphasis on fans, but I appreciate it's so wide ranging because it would be easier for you to sort of focus on bigger clubs, and that's not what you do. You always have a non-league account there. You're writing about a championship game between QPR and Rotherham. And I'm actually going to just use my own little anecdotes here.
So this is where I went off on a little bit of a monologue about my own football experiences in the UK on this extended trip I've just gotten back from. I went to see my team Crystal Palace play in Nottingham, but I went down from Yorkshire to that match on a Saturday, and it was a lovely day out. I was impressed by Nottingham. We also stopped off in Sheffield. I changed trains there, where fans were coming in for Sheffield United. Very cheerful, despite the fact that they probably knew they were going to get relegated from the Premier League this year, which they have been. And I also saw a game between Hull and Middlesbrough, Hull up in Yorkshire, close to where I've been staying when I've been there. I've been to that ground a few times, no bad seats there. I talked about how the away games now in the Premier League are capped for away fans at £30. That's about less than $40. The Hull game was £22, so are no bad seats there. £23, I need to state that. £23, there's no bad seats at Hull. It's a great stadium. And then a couple of weeks later, I talked my friend in South London into coming along to see Brom. Play, that's a posh suburb of South London. Two teams that could be, you know, could be in the fourth tier of the English Football League next year, but for now they're officially non-league football. And when we walked up for that one, it was £22, only a pound cheaper than at Hull, and only £8 cheaper than being an away fan in the Premier League. And I wanted to ask the others, as well as talking about how much fun all of this football has been to witness it in person, I wanted to ask everybody what they thought of that very, very minor economic difference between the second tier and fifth tier football costs, and whether that represented something about a north-south divide economically, which historically in the UK has tended to be very pronounced.
What do you think, Andy? What does everybody think about that?
I think it's partly an effect of, I mean, obviously the negative side of the Premier League. I mean, the Premier League clubs pretty much across the board have been putting up their season ticket prices on a regular basis. During COVID, the clubs have kind of made a big issue of, oh, you know, how valuable our fans are to us and so forth. But the amount of money that Premier League clubs make from season tickets is a tiny fraction in a lot of cases. I think 10% in terms of, in case of Manchester City, of their total income. They don't need to put up the season ticket prices because they get loads of other money from TV, from sponsorship, from their owners and so on. But they choose to do it. And a lot of fans are now very unhappy about it. Fans at Liverpool and at Manchester City and Tottenham recently have had protests inside the stadium at the fact that clubs are hiking up season ticket prices. In the case of Spurs, also they're cutting discounts for senior citizens. I think they're going to drop those completely in a couple of years. But one of the effects of the expense involved in going to Premier League games is that, I think, is that a lot more people now do follow football lower down. So lower down, that like so the fifth or sixth level of English football, the crowds are bigger, average crowds are bigger than they've ever been. So that's a good thing in a way. It means lots of kids whose parents can't afford to take them to see major teams anymore are now watching their local clubs. I think some of the local clubs perhaps are cashing in perhaps a bit more than they should in terms of what you say about the price at Bromley relative to the price at Hull, which is about three levels higher. But I think in general, it's broadly a positive thing that there is a lot of younger people especially are getting to see or are going to matches. So the key thing always about going to games is that you're consuming football on your own terms, essentially, as a spectator. You're not just a TV couch potato, if you like, who's absorbing what you're being given by television. You can experience a game in a different way. There's a whole load of different things you can see at the football ground as well as the match itself. And I think it's good for younger people to get that experience, and fewer of them now are able to get that experience at the bigger clubs. So they are, a lot of them are evidently moving down to watch the local non-league teams, which is broadly a good thing, I would say.
Yeah, I'd like to bring Mike back in on this in just a moment, actually. Kevin, do you feel connected to the Arsenal hierarchy, that, you know, the club? I don't know what it costs to see Arsenal at the Emirates these days. Like I say, at least away games are capped, but is that part of the mission of a fanzine, to sort of replace or demand even that connection with your ownership?
Well, certainly we've frequently been critical of the ownership because of the the price rises as much as anything, as well as their at times seeming lack of interest in actually developing the team. Because certainly if, when I was editor, I confessed that much as Arsene Wenger was brilliant for us, his time was up a good few years before he actually went.
It was, yeah.
So there was this, for us, this idea that everything was based on the balance sheet. So as long as the club were making profit, the owners didn't care whether we were not winning trophies or competing for the league championship or going out regularly in the Champions League before the quarterfinals. So as football fans, we wanted a winning mentality rather than a balance book mentality. So we attack them on that front. And in terms of the club, it's a weird dilemma, because in terms of the ownership, quite often, especially Manchester United being a classic example of this, there's a feeling of us and them being the people that in theory own the club. And yet at the same time, we want the club to do well, so we love the club. We just hate the people that are running it. So there's that whole dynamic there, which as supporters, sometimes it's hard to actually make progress on, because as long as the stadium is selling out, which is what happens at Arsenal, the club don't care. And so they're going to keep putting the prices up because they're selling out.
Yeah.
And it's a vicious circle. And there's got to, I mean, the interesting thing is how much people are prepared to pay. And if you go to the States and you look at the prices people are prepared to pay to watch sport there, you do wonder if there's a cap of any sort. And that ultimately, the only cap will be when there's a single seat they don't sell and realize that's the limit. So in that respect, it's sometimes hard to love the club because yeah. of what they do. And as Andy has said, you know, they don't need this money. The big clubs, the ones that get all the money from television and sponsorship, do not need the gate money that they get. It's such... Bromley probably do. And in fairness, the reason they probably charge £22 is because they're not getting that kind of revenue from advertising, certainly not from television. So they actually need... They rely on the money they make on the gate, which is why they've got to charge £22.
I think that's a fair point, actually, and I haven't really thought about it. And I had a good time. I also suspect there's a lot of people on different membership schemes, like my friend at Hull, that are, you know, got family memberships, and you know, it comes down enormously. Mike, as a supporter of you know, another Yorkshire club, you probably were you know, hearing me talk about Hull there. You're also halfway down, I just took a look before we started, halfway down League Two, so you're not in danger of dropping out of what we used to call the Football League, but it's not definitely not glory days right now. Where does this, does Bradford, if I came to a game on this trip, would I still get that sort of family vibe? Would I get that, you know, supporters can afford to go, the club and the fans have a connection in a way that we're hearing clubs like Arsenal or Manchester United no longer have?
Yeah, it was. If you'd have come to some recent games, maybe that wouldn't have been the case.
You don't have the same kind of issues with your club ownership that Kevin's expressing.
We have issues with our club ownership.
Who owns Bradford? Who owns Bradford?
It's a chap called Stefan Rupp. He's a German. He basically got conned into buying the football club. Back in 2016 by somebody, another German who needed a backer, and it just all fell apart within a couple of years. To be fair to him, he's like a benevolent owner. He lives in Germany. He's been once this season, last month he came for the first time for ages because things have not been going well. And he's put a statement out saying that, yeah, he understands that things are not been going well and we've got to do better. So let's see, you know, actions speak louder than words. But yeah, so we're fortunate that I don't know, it's a tricky one, but yeah, it's all there in the latest two fanzines that I've sent you.
Yeah, it absolutely is, and it's interesting that you've outlived the club program, because one of the things that you write about is you've got somebody who reviews all the programs he actually buys on his away days, and I like that. That's a good feature. And talking about your German owner, another feature that jumped out at me was, and honestly, I thought this could have been in When Saturday Comes. It was of that level. It's the top 10 worst club owners. And I learned a lot there. I wasn't surprised that the whole previous owner was in there. I learned a lot in that. So what I liked about that was it was something that if for somebody who doesn't really couldn't name a player on the Bradford team, there was a reason to be reading a Bradford publication, fanzine.
Yeah, no, and very much. I mean, we're sort of we are Bradford City centric, as it were. But my contributors send in random things, and I'm happy that we cover not just Bradford City. Yeah, of course. It's going to be one of those things where, you buy a Bradford City fanzine, you're going to be reading about Bradford City. But there's also, hopefully, as you've just found out, there's a few interesting bits and pieces that are not just they're just what we call general stuff. So I'm pleased that you found that interesting.
Great. I've got massively quick questions, then we're going to wrap this up. These are like just straight answers. What's your circulation now, Mike?
We print somewhere between 900 and 700. I mean, we start off at 900, depending on the season. The latest issue, because I've only got two home games on this latest issue, I've only printed 700. So we're sort of like between, let's say we average about 800.
Fascinating observation, just from somebody who was in at doing a fanzine in the 70s, late 70s, that the print costs have the whole print structure, digital has changed so much that you and Kevin can put out these incredibly professional full color magazines with such a small print run, because the thing that always hampered fanzines back in the day was that unless you had access to somebody's photocopier, litho didn't make financial sense unless you could be printing 1,000, 1,500, 2,000. And that was out of the range of a fanzine that was trying to get going. So that's just a big change in change in culture. Andy, this seems relatively obvious, but did you name When Saturday Comes after the Undertones song? Or was it something
Well,
that...
in the we did. Mike, who was the co-founder, was a big Undertones fan. I wasn't so much of a fan of those actually, but we did discover later on that there was actually a poem about football called "When Saturday Comes," and written in the early 70s by Alan Plater, who's a famous playwright from Hull, actually. Who was a TV playwright and a writer. So we wonder whether the fellow from the Undertones, Damien O'Neill, I think, who wrote the song "When Saturday Comes," maybe he got the idea for the title from this poem about football. So in a roundabout way, possibly it was a football term first.
When I took that trip down to Nottingham from Beverley, we had to change trains at Sheffield, and despite the fact we were getting into Sheffield at midday, there were a lot of Sheffield United fans already coming into town, probably have lunch or just hit the pub early, get to the ground early. And you know what? They were unbelievably cheerful and still optimistic. And I think, to say when Saturday comes, people still go to the matches and believe in their team. And they looked like they were having fun in the Premiership. They scored three goals at home that day, which astonished people. They didn't win. It was 3-3. The people I was talking to, because they saw my Palace scarf and everybody wanted to know what the hell I was doing, where I was coming from. And that sense of belief is just something that I think unites football fans, that when Saturday comes, all things are possible, and you can be looking at, maybe being this team at the bottom of a table that's continually losing, and you say the season's not over yet. And that's one of the beautiful things about the game. And I think the banter between fans is a part of our popular culture, our social culture, and that the football fanzines, whether or not they've been superseded by podcasts and YouTube videos and whatever else, have found a way over the last 40 years to put that culture into print, and that football's all the better for having that culture put into print. And so thank you for all of you at different levels for what you've done for that culture. And, long may it survive. Long may it
Okay, if
survive.
I could just sort of just chip in very much there, because I think we've all been part. I mean, I obviously City Gent is still very much living as is when Saturday comes. The Gooners carries on with a different editor to Kevin, but I always try and, as I mentioned about, it was important to make City Gent during the COVID. The fact is that we are creating just little bits of history. Whenever our heritage fanzines bite the dust, as it were. hopefully, and my hope is that, you know, even long after I've gone, that some, you know, and as long as Bradford's here and as long as we're all gathering on at a football ground at 3 o'clock, staring at the centre circle, as we do all of us up and down the country, that somebody might find a fanzine and think, wow, this is fascinating. You know, and in some ways, I'm sure that, you know, all those punk fanzines, you find a punk fanzine from the 70s. Wow, this was, look who was making this. So I think we are, you know, not to get too up ourselves a little bit, but the fact is we are creating little bits of history that it might not be apparent just now, but I'd like to think that these things will be looked back on. You know, and yeah, while we can continue to make them, it can, and yeah, you know, I concur with everything that Kevin said about the fact that, you know, we just are, and City Gent is very much just playing towards a loyal fan base that are keeping us going. And the fact that I've got enough people still buying it, I've got enough people contributing that keeps us going, and it'll keep going as long as I probably choose to keep it going. But, you know, these are little, just little pieces of printed history that will remain long after those articles on websites disappear.
Very, very true. Good last words. Thank you, everybody, for taking part. Thanks for putting in so much time on this. Thanks for doing what you do. And, you know, best wishes to all your clubs, unless you're playing mine. That's how it goes.
Thanks. Thank you, Tony.
Thank you, Tony.
Cheers, Tony. Thanks a lot.